welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. We use that nice melodic music instead of our usual abrasive intro, a montage, because this is a very special episode. Usually we cover news, issues, and the problems of our time and the solutions from a radical post-capitalist perspective with a Three Left Show representing socialism, anarchism, and ecology, deep ecology. What do all those mean? What do they mean when they're put together? We're going to discuss some of that today. This show is dedicated to the topic solar punk. Now, that is probably a new term for many of you. It is only a few years old, created by a Tumblr post. But otherwise, you may be aware of cyberpunk if you've watched any sci-fi movie since the 80s. So with me in the studio right now is Sage. So your Blade Runner,
Blade Runner is totally what I can.
Yeah.
Think
so
of.
So we, when it comes to imagining the future, since 1972, pretty much was a turning point. As one writer put it, the future has been stolen. It's why Disney's Tomorrowland stopped being re-renovated. It's why we stopped having moon missions. And all NASA can afford to do is send robots, and I think they can barely do that.
Oh, they're sending lots of satellites up now. New development there. Trump is indeed putting mad money into the space program.
For the Space Corps.
Yeah.
That's what it was really about. So.
Oh, yeah, it's always been about
the
military.
Instead of being the story... Oh, that it's... Okay, spending on NASA for the military purpose instead of the scientific purpose.
Yep.
So
yeah, and the science creates a nice public persona for the whole thing.
Do you think that was a buried lead? So, let's see. What was the other kind of punk?
Solar
punk. Oh, yeah, sorry. Steampunk. Steampunk, which is nostalgia for an imagined past. The Victorian era where no one is sexist and there's no... imperialism isn't really important. But that is... there's almost a reactionary feeling to it that it's like, you know, we want to go with the past and we imagine it was good. That's what nationalists do. That's what fascists do. It's just something they have in common. Otherwise, it's a very geeky subculture. But solar punk is instead a purely, I call it aesthetic movement as far as that it is a way of doing things and a way of taking things we are doing on the fringes of society, which are ecological, community-based. So my general definition here that I've cobbled together is that it is defined as an ecological activism, systems of infrastructure as forms of resistance, and that means social infrastructure as well as physical, the sharing of technology and resources, so it feeds off of movements for against copyright, sharing of technology, and another commons economy stuff that we like mentioning here. Futures that depend on community. Most futures we imagine, either on Hollywood screen or even in a lot of sci-fi, it's very individualistic. It's the one man against nature, the one man against the future. What defense can there be against the future? The future as something unknown and frightening and dangerous. And let's see. And it's a herding of the best ideas of old and new tech. Permaculture, which is intense gardening, intense ecological gardening, where you plant... main thing is where you plant certain plants that repel... pests, so you do not need to use pesticide. So it's part of, like, instead of going for the technical solution, the industrial solution, the one that requires vast amounts of resources and usually harming nature and ourselves, because we're part of nature, and that's part of it as well, seeing ourselves as part of nature and not opposed to it, in looking for the biological solution. What plants can I put around my garden bed to keep the pests away? I need a combination of plants, they work together. Maybe this plant will attract predators of the pests.
Yeah, looking for ecological solutions as opposed to just tech solutions, like using mushrooms for insulation. That's a another rather solar punk
thing.
Yeah, or like if anybody can figure out climate change solutions that are more ecological rather than just trying to engineer it away. Yes, and at the moment
they are all small scale. It's like just people experimenting. So to then, as science fiction does, to take these little pockets of potential and then expand on them and see where could this go, how far can we take it? I think that's the way you were putting it. And to respond to the dearth of imagination that late capitalism / neoliberalism, what we call our current system of economics, law, politics, and culture that gives us Trump, we need to go away from that to go forward. We need new relations. We need new futures. Because otherwise, even now, what kind of sci-fi are we getting? Either rehashes of things that were made 30, 40 years ago, apocalyptic stuff, even when it has a hopeful message like Wolverine, it's still a corporate-dominated nightmare. And it's just about just trying to get away from it, and usually not totally succeeding.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of each new millennium and roughly like every half century or so, people's imaginations start to go rather wild. Like the year 2000, there's a lot of speculation about like, whoa, like we're going into the future. Like, what's it going to be like? And I think there's a lot of like articles and fiction shows and artwork and things that were looking at all these possibilities of the future. But it all kind of fizzled out, and nobody's really come up with a big, hey, here's my big vision of the future thing that a lot of people could get behind until now.
I think I can tell you what happened. So yeah, that's usually, I would label that as the techno-utopianism that still exists within the gated communities of Tech Valley and the tech industry. That tech can solve all the problems, we can still save society, make smart cities. Smart cities make for dumb citizens, but that's that's my comment.
Yeah, get overly reliant on the tech.
And that ended with the economic crash. It's like, well, we're just getting better, and of course you still have those moderates and liberals saying that things are still better than they've ever been. For the top, but that's kind of how it is. I mean, if you look, Flint has no good water, and Flint is not alone in communities with tainted water or water infrastructure that is woefully under invested. And that goes for everything in our lives, and our local politics suffers for it. No money to spend on society, only money to spend on military, and we just mentioned that with NASA.
Yeah, I think another important thing about solar punk is that it's rejecting this opposition between technology and nature that people have been talking about for many decades. It's being compatibilist about it, as opposed to this all or nothing attitude that a lot of people like to take.
But we need to think about biological technologies or technologies that are inspired by nature. Can you see that in some design circles? I know in architecture it exists in spades. Then those kind of these videos on Facebook I see now and then that show up in my feed that are like showing off the best new technology. Sometimes it's like the lab grown meat or some product that I'm like, well, you could use this to cut down on your waste, or you could just cut down on your waste. And it's like you have to buy something to do a job that you could just do yourself for the same effort. It's like, well, when you pay money to do something, you are handing over some of your time as labor, You work to make that money. It's like, use your time for this, to make the money as like to pay a middleman, or just put in the 5 minutes to recycle or to reuse X product in your life. Something like that. And I'm probably too far from the mic. Why don't we go towards, to finish up our intro, the Notes Toward a Manifesto. So this is one of the early kind of writings. So solar punk, it's like trying to create a literary movement from scratch, because that's usually how we think about sci-fi. It starts as literature, then an art, and then it becomes films, TV, and then it gets serialized on shows like The Twilight Zone or Doctor Who, something like that, something more geeky, and thus becomes part of mass culture. And it's nowhere near that, that's for sure. But I think in the coming years, maybe we'll crowdsource some of that media.
This is Solarpunk, Notes Toward a Manifesto. It's hard out there for futurists under 30. As we percolated through our respective nations' education systems, we were exposed to world-changing and TED talks to artfully designed green consumerism and sustainable development NGOs. Yet we also grew up with doomsday predictions slated to hit before our expected retirement ages, with the slow but inexorable militarization of metropolitan police departments, with the failure of the existing political order to deal with the existential but not yet urgent threat of climate change. Many of us feel it's unethical to bring children into a world like ours. We've grown up under a shadow, and if we sometimes resemble fungus, it should be taken as a credit to our adaptability. We're solarpunks, because the only other options are denial or despair. The promises offered by most singularitarians and transhumanists are individualists and unsustainable. How many of them are scoped for a world where energy is not cheap and plentiful, to say nothing of rare earth elements?
The things that make our cell phones, which all come from China, by the way. So when there's a trade embargo or trade war, that's going to affect that.
Solarpunk is about finding ways to make life more wonderful for us right now, and more importantly, for the generations that follow us, i.e. extending human life at the species level, rather than individually. Our future must involve repurposing and creating new things from what we already have, instead of 20th century destroy it all and build something completely different modernism. Our futurism is not nihilistic like cyberpunk, and it avoids steampunk's potentially quasi-reactionary tendencies. Is about ingenuity, generativity, independence, and community. And yes, there's a punk there, not just because it's become a trendy suffix. There's an oppositional quality to solarpunk, but it's an opposition that begins with infrastructure as a form of resistance. We're already seeing it in the struggles of public utilities to deal with the explosion in rooftop solar. Dealing with infrastructure is a protection against being robbed of one's self-determination, said Chokwa Lumba, the late mayor of Jackson, and he was right. Certainly there are good reasons to have a grid, and we don't want it to rot away. But one of the healthy things about local resistance is that it puts you in a much better bargaining position against the people who might want to shut you off.
That was local resilience. The ability to be off the grid.
Solarpunk draws on the ideal of Jefferson's human farmer, Gandhi's ideal of Swadeshi, and subsequent Salt March, and countless other traditions of innovative dissent. FWIW, both Gandhi and Jefferson were inventors. The visual aesthetics of solarpunk are open and evolving. As it stands, it's a mashup of the following: 1800s, age of sail/frontier living, but with more bicycles. Creative reuse of existing infrastructure, sometimes post-apocalyptic, sometimes present, weird. Jugaad-style innovation from the developing world. High-tech backends with simple, elegant outputs. Obviously, the further you get into the future, the more ambitious you can get. In the long term, solarpunk takes the images we've been fed by bright green blogs and draws them out further, longer, and deeper. Imagine permaculturalists thinking in cathedral time. Consider terrace irrigation systems that also act as fluidic computers. Contemplate the life of Department of Recreation
Reclamation
officer managing a sparsely populated American Southwest given over to solar collection and pump storage. Imagine smart cities being junked in favor of smart citizenry. Tumblr lit up within the last week from this post envisioning a form of solarpunk with an Art Nouveau Edwardian garden aesthetic, which is gorgeous and reminds me of Miyazaki. There's something lovely in the way it reacts against the mainstream visions of overly smooth, clean, white, modernist iPod futures. Solarpunk is a future with a human face and dirt behind its ears. That was written, September 4th, 2014, in Hieroglyph.
So I'm going to move on. I have a little video queued up. This is called Solarpunk in Trump's America via a YouTube blogger, Texas Watson.
Solar Punk Press ended the day before Trump got elected, so it's been hard to get in the mood to talk about Solar Punk in the past couple weeks. But I've had some time to acclimate, and now I want to talk about what Solar Punk activism is in a Trump presidency. It means resistance in every sense. A couple weeks ago, it looked like we were going to be fighting in the US to push hard to make a fundamentally liberal establishment live up to the highest form of its ideals. Now we know we're facing an administration that rejects facts, that rejects personhood, that rejects compassion. First and foremost, American solar punk should understand that Trump is just one manifestation of a global wave of fascism. This isn't just our problem. It's the world's. Second, solar punks should take Trump at his word. A person who makes it to office promising massive human rights violations doesn't get a grace period in which we wait to see whether he was serious. He may backpedal, but he's backpedaling from atrocity to mere horror. Third, solar punks should embrace the diversity of tactics. This is one of my favorite phrases that came out of American activism. It's an alternative to the maxim of nonviolence, saying those who follow it intend to do what optimizes for the respect of human life. That means nonviolence, when it's proportionate, but it also means self-defense and aggression against openly murderous enemies. I think in today's activism, diversity of tactics has another important connotation, all the way on the other end. Participate in the system. Engage in local politics. Vote and help other punks vote. Do what you can in local government to build islands of safety, insulating from the federal level. Build local counterexamples to the narratives of how government works in America. It isn't a form of hypocrisy to vote to minimize harm while you work to build systematic alternatives to the state as it exists. It's not a form of hypocrisy to vote all the way down the ballot, not because these people represent your best interests, but because they'll be easier to lobby than their opponents. A better future doesn't blossom if no one plants seeds. So make gardens out of town hall where radical politicians grow, and see what happens to the tower of fascism when the bottom floor crumbles. Sorry for mixing metaphors. But just as we can expect the fascist state to move faster than reason suggests it should, systematic harms can collapse faster than we might anticipate when we foster a political environment that's hospitable to informed and compassionate politicians. Bye.
Thoughts?
Yeah, that's pretty sick stuff. I thought, the point on, working with local politics to create, shelter from the federal situation. That's a very interesting example of diversity of tactics. It's the on-grid and the off-grid working together.
There's two things we can relate to that. One is the story you're bringing about the activist who stopped the deportation of someone in Sweden. You want to talk about that? I vamp about how there's going to be a second Unite the Right rally, but this time in D.C., and so there's a call out to not repeat what happened in Charlottesville, because when leftists or the left-leaning or the anti-fascist, those you don't have to be leftist. You can just be anti-fascism, anti-neo-Nazi, to actually say, yeah, this is too far. We're not going to tolerate this. Neutrality is still a position. It's still an action that you take. An action that can support the status quo. And the status quo, if it's the fascist status quo or fascist-leaning one, it's one that tolerates fascism. It's one that actually helps it, as the police in various cities do. At certain events, you'll have 3% or militia types who aren't the police handcuff or detain someone and then hand them over to the cops. And they basically do a verbal high five. So that's happening August 4th and 5th, the weekend after this. And so I'm just going to mention that there's that opposition to fascism directly, and it's a confrontation. But like in Boston, if we outnumber them 10 to 1 or 3 to 1, they stand down. They know they're beaten. If it's in parity, meaning equal numbers, that's where you get, as reported by the corporate media, clashes. And with all the police that will be there in any of these situations, the police do more to hinder the anti-fascists than the fascists, with some exceptions. But in Portland, as reported last week or the previous episode, they were to the detriment. They very much see the left as more of a threat, as most of our government does, and always has. Do you have that news story? You
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so a recent example of resistance, and this is a rather interesting tactic. Let's see. Ellen Erison a 21-year-old college student, refused to take her seat on a plane that was about to take off because there was somebody being deported to Afghanistan on the flight. So, if you don't know, when you're on a plane, the regulations are that everybody has to be seated for the flight to take off. So she, got her ticket and everything, all legit, but refused to sit down. So the flight couldn't take off. And
she pre-planned this. I think that's a detail worth mentioning. That she knew that someone was being deported on this plane, which is odd information to come by. When I think about others wanting to replicate this, I think there needs to be, hopefully she does an interview or two and says how she retained this information and the kind of how to. Because a lot of interviews will talk about their motivations and things, but not the how. I think other activist shows will do that, but there's so few. I think that's kind of where we come in, fill that gap. As there are other podcasts are that do that. One is called Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. That has an equal number of episodes as us.
Damn straight we are.
And another is Giving the Mic to the Wrong Person. So shout outs to them. Although at this point, they would be bumping us if they mentioned us and not really the other way around.
Yeah, so, a lot of people got very upset with her. But, the Afghani was indeed not deported on that flight. The kicker here, though, is that apparently this kind of thing has been happening slowly but surely here and there. And, they're starting to deport people on more and more in private flights now. As they're finding they can't get away with the public flights as easily. So, trick from here is we got to figure out, where are these private flights taking off from, and is there any way to disrupt those?
Yeah, we can also see it as costing, when you fight a guerrilla war or any kind of struggle like this, it is all about costing them as much money as possible, make it so expensive to do these deportations that there will be less of them. As well as
make the difficulty too high to be worth it.
And it can be a death by a thousand cuts. Cut being the expenditure. But then we'll find that, our established governments, local or national, are so set with their policy. No amount of spending will, because the money is meaningless. They can just borrow more. And especially when it comes to maintaining the order that we, the order of global capital.
National security.
That will always be funded. There will always be more credit for that, but not for healthcare and taking care of us. And not like babies, but I mean in a societal sense. Let me be clear.
Yeah, speaking of healthcare, this is another very recent story. A anarchist collective called the Four Thieves Vinegar Collective are doing a lot to push DIY medicine. So you probably know about EpiPens being made astronomically expensive, among other things.
Yes. And to clarify, these are the pens that if someone goes into an allergy shock, it's an emergency measure.
Yep. So. What these guys are doing is, they have a site, fourthievesvinegar.org, and they're making and showing you how to make DIY EpiPens, Daraprim for HIV, and Narcan, among other things.
That's to prevent heroin overdose.
Yep.
It's that drug.
So, head over to fourthievesvinegar.org, and you can find guides on how to make these things. Yep.
Yeah, kind of like Anarchist Cookbook of Medicine, the kind of do-it-yourself, it's a do-it-yourself culture taken to beyond just crafts and little home projects to, those are individual items, take it to the community level. And we'll mention this later about guerrilla everything, not just guerrilla gardening, which is just planting things randomly around town in any patch of dirt that's unclaimed or neglected. Pretty much abandoned. City says we don't have money for flowers. You know, it's not that expensive. You can literally just scatter plant things, and there's 1 in 5 chance it'll grow.
Yeah. More importantly, food. You know, we want food growing everywhere. I mean, yeah, the big idea is, you know, anything that's provided by the state, we should be able to provide for ourselves. Because in the end, it is just people making this stuff at the end of the day. We'd be doing this with or without the state anyways, so let's do more without the state.
This goes into how our economic system tells us or doesn't tell us how it produces value. So a home and a property's value is based on, well, A, the ability to live there, okay, as if it's a house, but also, like, its ability to gain value over time, and so on. These are the things that mortgage payment and other things are based on. And it's resale later on. And it's why house flipping is a thing even after the crash. But a lot of these homes and properties are actually unproductive. Usually on the assumption that anyone who could buy it in the first place or rehab it is middle class and has resources already. Thus, someone on a minimum wage or even moderate $30,000 a year income cannot afford to buy a house or make mortgage payments. It's just not tenable without outside help, without inherited wealth. Right, you know, parents paying that first down payment, something like that. Can you do it on your own? Not really. And when it comes to the mortgage, classic the public state mortgage agency, your Fannie Mac, and here it's Sunny Mae in New York. There's all these criteria where it's like it can't rent to other people. It's just for the one family, the nuclear family. There's just kind of a lack of risk taking involved, you know, because I asked the Sunny Mae mortgage person at a workshop, what if I want to start a co-op or have a group co-housing, these new forms of housing that are kind of really needed, because that single occupant homesteader doesn't work when there's no good jobs. And he basically said, no, this is too risky. No bank in the area will loan to that. And thus it can't be guaranteed by us, and we don't do that. And so that was a letdown.
Ooh, praying value to the community.
Right, so...
capitalism
at work. So to turn that back to using land to grow food and create value, it's just that on the marketplace, food has zero value. It's almost... it's close to... zero marginal cost. It's like copying digital files almost. It's so cheap to grow food, a lot of it, especially when it's mass done, that there's no way you can sell food on the market and make your money back to cut even. You can cut even, but not make a net, a profit. And that's why the second trade is squeezed the tiniest bit with foreign markets, all of the farmers in the Midwest need subsidies. Federal subsidies on top of the subsidies they already get. Dairy industry here in New York, the pride of New York or Wisconsin, totally is like subsidized, would not be able to exist without public support, which, okay, public support is fine. As far as like your state socialism, but it's still in private hands. It's still for the sake of private profits. It's not really for the public good, because it's not actually publicly owned, community managed, and democratic. You know, that's state capitalism for you, or rather,
yeah, it's going from the public to
the state supports the private sector instead of the other way around. Weird tangent there. So where to go now?
So solar park. Well,
we still have a few more minutes before our next break. Do you want to hit a excerpt from? I don't know if I have too much. How about instead of reading an actual excerpt, I'll just talk about one of the stories. So I bought the book Sunvault, which is, so when it comes to solar punk, it's all kind of, we're even speculating about the aesthetic movement, the genre, right? What is solar punk architecture? What is solar punk art? And a lot of that Tumblr blog is just people kind of proposing things. And so here we have released this year a collection of science fiction stories, speculative eco fiction. And so I bought that book via my local book seller, because it had to be ordered. Actually, they didn't want to send it online, interestingly enough. And so one of the stories, and we were talking about this, it was kind of let down for me because some of the stories are apocalyptic, but with a ray of hope at the end. One of the stories is called Last Chance, and it's sci-fi, and that takes place in space. And there's, you have this colony, and it's kind of Fallout-y where there's this bunker, and the kids are being brought out to see how dead the planet is. And like, this is what happened because we polluted everything, and now we're stuck in bunkers. And the twist that's led on early on, so it's not a full Twilight Zone episode, so to speak, but it's close to one, in that the bunker and the dead environment is actually just the desert on a planet that's actually very nice. But it's the last good habitable planet. And it's about training the kids to value the life that is here so that they will not waste, they will act sustainable, and it's for their own good to be so cruel, to deprive them in childhood up to their teen years of actual like childhood in nature, to have them in a bunker. And so it plays with that morality quite a lot. From the perspective of the head teacher, one of the head teachers. And that's one of the stories. Another is a future where everyone lives in these air pods in the sky because the ground is uninhabitable. But everyone is so isolated from each other, it's just everyone has their own individual pod. And there's a romance that develops between two people.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
A shared past. Where, because they're both descendants of people from China.
Yeah, it's a thing of the past.
Yeah, it's totally. Well, but there is a class society as far as the height you're allowed to be. So there's the stratosphere and the troposphere, and there's still a hierarchy of sorts. I forget how one's better than the other. I think it's about temperature.
Yeah, and the Earth's surface is just a big dump.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, dumps or stuff on Earth.
Wally style. So. Wally, I think that's a kind of version of, you know, we can ruin everything, but we can be redeemed with enough time.
Yeah, it is a little bit solar punk, isn't it?
Another solar punk piece of media that I've encountered, I wouldn't call it solar punk, but it's sci-fi with a ecological bent. It's the oddest show, but it's based on comic like everything else. So in the 80s, there's an early 90s, a show called Cadillacs and Dinosaurs. It sounds very cray, but it is so. It's after hundreds of years of being stuck in shelters, mankind emerges to a world reconquered by dinosaurs, and there's this group of people who are like ecological workers, and they want to maintain the balance of nature, and one of them, however, rebuilt Cadillac cars and drives around in them.
Oh, that's neat.
It's the comic is called Zeozoic Tales.
And when was this from? Because
early 90s. It's all on YouTube.
Of course.
The whole series is there on YouTube. It was unprofitable enough and canceled, so there's no hard copyright on it. And
that sounds gold.
And you have like kind of a... So I'm going to stop there. But anyway, it has these ecological messages, the balance of nature, not abusing technology, because that was the downfall of the ancestors. And they literally just destroyed everything, and now there's just these little bands. So we'll point on that framing of the future, as we can only be ecological after 80% of us have died. So we're going to turn. So we are going to continue with excerpts, but this will be fun. So this is the first story in the book here. It's called The Boston Herb Project, and refers to. Well, I'll get to it. So the framing device is someone applying to this radical university, and it's kind of like a series of emails, and how like the question is, how am I good at teamwork? You know, that standard job interview question. And he answers that in a very interesting way. So he starts by relating how he was in a national gaming competition called Freon Esports. And it involves augmented reality kits, and you have controllers who then direct the players on the field.
Here.
So this is high tech, and cyberpunk is defined in the shortest possible way: high tech, low lives. And solarpunk is maybe that high life via everything. And so let's see. And he worked with a guy named Kay, St. Anne, team captain. Kay lived in an old retrofitted church with a windmill on the spire and transparent solar panels in front of the stained glass windows. There were always 8 or 9 people living there, though the specifics varied. Kay and some other tech geeks used the basement as a hacker space, and she led a group of other volunteers use the kitchen to make food to give away almost every day. They fed us too, but I'm pretty sure Kay paid for a lot of the supplies. What I did with Kay was the most rewarding and important thing I've ever done so far in my life. To explain why, I need to establish 2 things. 1. The rate of winter deaths of homeless people in Boston has been increasing every year since climate change has made weather patterns more and more erratic. The city was never equipped to protect the homeless during polar vortexes, and it was getting worse, not better. There have been no new construction of homeless facilities and 2 closures in the last 5 years. 2. The city of Boston built and was about to open a new living building, the Hale Center. It was a big 15-story Art Deco revival temple with a custom-engineered closed ecosystem. It was basically a first-class hotel set up so that business people and politicians wouldn't have to go around interacting with the actual city. And it's the most thoroughly self-supported smart building to date in Massachusetts. We thought we would go to better use as a house for the city's homeless, so we decided to take it over. If you want to confirm, Google the Boston Hearth Project. For mainstream news on my favorite write-up about it is in The Guardian. But overall, the news is only really good for confirming that it happened. You won't see my name in any articles, although I am credited in the Hearth Project website as a volunteer. We were going to do it like we did Freon matches. I'd run an AR panel and guide a teammate. Kay had taken apart the FAR kits, this is the AR reality, Google Glass kind of thing, and put them back together several times, and she basically knew how to make one. She used an open source AR platform called ArgR to build ArgKit and made it mimic as closely as possible the gameplay style interaction that Freon had used. She was managing probably 3 or 4 teams of people on this project, so after building the system, she did one last thing before leaving me pretty much in charge of the plan. She introduced me to Juniper. Juniper Berg is an urban explorer, which means she's very good at breaking into buildings. She is also applying to XSU this year. You should let her in, and also you shouldn't hold she's good at breaking into buildings against her. She's a tracksuit, she does parkour, which is a much more versatile athletic skill set than Conrad had, the teammate. They took a lot of getting used to. When we trained, it took a long time before I stopped failing to notice what she saw as the most sensible way to achieve objective, which usually included getting into places that looked impossible to reach. Practicing with AugR was like learning to operate another body. I learned new limits for what was physically possible. I know how far back Juniper's arms can go before they hurt. I know how much farther before they'll keep hurting afterward. I know how high she can jump. I know how soft she can land. Which makes me think of Mirror's Edge, aside. 2 days before the night of the show, that's what we were calling it on the case of being recorded, we moved my kit to a hotel room up the street from the building where Juniper and I stayed to be ready. It was a very expensive room, and it felt less safe being so physically close, but we needed the fast response times through our own ad hoc wireless network, which was made of signal-carrying bugs Kay and her colleagues had stuck all around shadowy parts of buildings on the street and around the Hill Center. My signals had to get to Juniper fast. The potential consequences of a bad lag spike ranged from getting caught to getting her killed. On the night, Juniper was dressed like a half-angel, half-spy. Her outfit was all dark blues and muted greens, which would stand out less than black in partial light. It was loose, but with almost no stray fabric. She had brought me a matching robe, so we'd have team colors. I was wearing it. Her visor was close up against her face, a sleek glass plane across her eyes. The prism technology encoding on the visor made it anti-reflective, obscured the AR display from the outside, and disrupted face-detecting software. There were cameras on the front and back, so I had a full 360-degree view of the world around her head. She had buzzed her long black hair off to avoid obscuring the camera's view. She had a few more gadgets as well. 2 nearly silent camera drones smaller than her fist, which can hover in place for about 2 hours or fly around for half an hour. a car key fob that was repurposed to transmit passwords wirelessly. Print obscuring fingertips sheaths, climbing glove sneakers, and a pair of slippers with about an inch of foam in them to muffle sound. My kit included a massive tablet monitor angled towards my lap, a schematic screen with annotations above it to the left, a web browser independent of the system to the right, disconnected from the Augur so it could be linked to the internet without compromising us, a central monitor to show me whatever displays I wanted movement to movement, and side monitors from window management. I had a stylus and so on. It's kind of like the detail orientation of Cyberpunk, but instead of describing crime syndicates and like how terrible like the hierarchy of the society is, it's activism. I love it.
What we're doing about it.
Huge advertising posters all around town were set up to turn into murals that said, "Help occupy the Hale" and "Come to Hale Homeless Shelter." The following morning, all with an artistic rendering of the Hale Center that featured key alterations and a link to the BostonHearthProject.org. So we'd never get a second shot if we were ready to defend the Hale against the police in the morning. Juniper kissed the top of my head and left the hotel room at 4 a.m. At 4:06, she was behind the Hale Center. She went for the six-story window because the first five stories had a different kind of window that wouldn't open wide enough. She used the key fob, and all the windows 15 feet around her slowly glided open. She rolled in, using her weight to pressure the screen partway out of its frame, bending it enough that she could slip through, but not so much that it disconnected on any emergency system triggering points. Juniper ditched her climbing gear and switched from sneakers to slippers, then left the conference room she landed in and headed for the northeastern stairwell. There she went to the sixth floor, to the third, over railings, in a few leaps, and made me a little dizzy. It was unnecessary, but she kind of likes to show off. Then back into the building proper. The northeast stairwell was primarily a fire escape, and so only led out to ground level. Basement access was a little more secured. The third floor was the top level of the atrium, so past a couple hallways, she was looking out over the entryway. This was the only place in the building containing a security guard. He was distracted by his phone. Juniper took out one of the mini-drones, unfurled its rings, and crouching, slipped close enough to the railing to drop it below, sliding back into the safe space out of sight. Once it was out of her hand, I turned it on, and it was flying after about a 3-foot drop. The atrium was lit like moonlight. Gentle, dim blues tinted everything, with only the rail lights of cars passing by providing the color and relief that would distinguish Juniper from a piece of furniture or a pattern on the wall. It was beautiful, but we could do a little better. I added a filter to Juniper's display that amplified certain color bands so she'd see the detail the guard wouldn't. I put the drone cameras on display into Juniper's field of view on the lower left, and I moved the drone down carefully until I could tuck it just under the second floor hallway. Walkway. Let's skip ahead. "Ready?" I said, with the augur relayed to her using a bone vibration, projecting no sound into the air. "I'm ready," she responded, in an utterly silent whisper that the augur picked up and vocalized on my end. It catches her pace, intonation, and mouth movements, and renders it in a computer tone, like somebody made a text-to-speech app with her accent. It's weird, but cute. We still use it instead of phone conversations sometimes. I dropped a countdown into her view. 3, 2, 1. She went over the railing and back under it, under the second floor, in the motion I didn't even really understand. The guard moved. 25%. Noise level. I put a quiet notification on Juniper's display, a bright yellow word that took over the point of her eyes, focused for a split second, then faded and moved to the side. She flattened herself into the corner of the floor of the wall, waiting for my signal. So after a lot of splinter cell type of action, I'm just going to skip ahead to...
get the original for...
to where she gets the jump on the guard. Turning off all the overrides, changing the passwords, changing out all of the ecological systems that make the building completely independent. That took about 7.5 minutes, and once she was done, Juniper bolted out of the room towards the stairs. The guard definitely heard her this time, and because she liked showing off, she left the stairwell at the second floor and headed for the atrium, vaulting over the railing and landing in a clean tumble to a still position on one knee. The guard saw her, pulled out his taser, pointed it, and fired. It missed completely. He looked a little bit like there was a chance he'd cry. "Put it down," she said. Walked to the door, she stood up. He walked to the door with his hands up. "Go out." He passed through the first bulletproof reinforced glass doorway, then the second, with Juniper behind him. The building is ours now. Get as far away as you can. He looked to his left and right. The threads of lines of people were converging on the building. So he ran away. Kay had a fob to get in and was set up with the new passwords we had prepped. She had activists bring in groups of folks coming in for refuge and coordinate the 200-odd people in small clusters. We had three friends ready to pick me up with my equipment, and we were in the Hale Center's parking garage before the first team of cops and riot gear showed up. The garage had massive triple gates that could slam the building utterly shut, so it could manage its climate internally in extreme weather. After we got in, the lowest entrances got locked down. We took the elevator to the front hall where people were still filing in. The air in the Hale Center is different than the city outside it. It smells like being outdoors, somewhere other than Boston. There's no smell of cars and mud and construction. There's no recycled air and cleaning product smell. There's a breeze, and it carries the varied and pleasant scents of the building's miniature biomes. It was overcast outside, starting to rain, but in the building the sun was rising. Lights like windows turned on and filled the big open space with engineer's daylight. The building was our weapon as well as our hostage. We let riot cops crowd into the first doorway and set the heat to 115. Then a subset of brave volunteers would wait until they were just about boiled and let them in the building. Maybe 10 or so got in at a time. And they hadn't already stripped off their armor, they had a heat stroke. We took everything and sent them back out in t-shirts and underwear. We disassembled their weapons, smashed important pieces of heavy objects, and rained them down guard gun parts on top of cop cars. We held the building against an active siege for 49 days, while a larger and larger body of volunteers came out of the city to join the cause. We had a great social media team, without whom we would never have gotten to keep the building. They made this a PR nightmare and railed enough public empathy to make negotiations viable. Stalemates led to agreements in which we brought in supplies and more people. The building became an art project, too. Artists rappelled down from the roof to paint the facade in luminescent yellows and oranges and beautifully annihilate the sleek, gray-blue, hyper-modern aesthetic that the architects had tried to carve into the city. The Boston Herf homeless shelter is now formally recognized, and New York and Portland have both turned over building projects to activists for fear of facing another hostile takeover. It's understaffed and underfunded. There are people who volunteer to do more work than they do in their full-time paying jobs. But having a building that's designed to turtle against the outside world makes an immense difference. And we're saving a lot of lives. There was a 92% drop in deaths by exposure in Boston this winter. But anyone proven to be connected with the takeover is still being prosecuted. Kay got a plea bargain for house arrest until 2025. She hasn't physically been in the hearth at all this year, and the cops are actively searching for whoever broke into the building that night, scared off the night guard. Teamwork was a central skill of the hearth project at every stage, planning and execution and follow-up, and in protecting each other from the state. This work deepened my understanding of and appreciation for collective action. It's hard, it has its costs, and it demands immense trust and intimacy. I'm excited to come to XSU to join the efforts to change the world that I don't have to keep so quiet. End.
Love that story. That was fiction for anybody who tuned in randomly.
This was speculative sci-fi. We do not endorse any of that. That was all legal, and we don't endorse any of it.
Yeah, I love how that story looks into a lot of, you know, existing and like about to exist technologies and gets very creative with it. I mean, like,
it's a conglomeration of things that hackers and hack activists
already do. Like, yeah, I've done their homework a bit.
You know, you take the parkour culture, the people who do parkour, urban exploring. You take the taking over squatting in buildings and using word of mouth and, you know, the PR of it. Now, usually these buildings are abandoned. And in Europe, there's a strong squatter movement and culture, and they've taken over elementary schools. And by take over, I mean like it's an abandoned public building. People move it, turn into a rad community center. And the kind of thing that we should eventually do with the YMCA on Washington Ave. Because I think it's underutilized. But again, it's like, well, you have to own it and you have to maintain it. It's a big built, old modern building with a lot of costs involved with maintaining it. So kind of when you squat, you need to almost retrofit it so you can maintain it, heat it, cool it on the cheap. And so when we have people who want to build more greenhouses attached in the buildings, and that helps heat them in the winter, and you can open that up and cool them off in the summer. And use all these passive technologies instead of active technologies that take a lot of mining that strips the earth, the energy. This techno-utopianism is that we can build enough solar panels to power all of the industry that we have now. And by industry, I just mean all the uses that we use energy for. And in essence, we don't have to, because we waste a lot of it. Everything we build and how we use energy, it's very inefficient. Even when you factor in the new efficiencies of light bulbs and caulking and insulation, it's still a lot of energy. A lot of it is wasted in transmission. All right, here's a factoid for you. 40% of all energy generated, whether it be a gas plant or even solar panels, a solar field, 30% is lost in transmission. A third of power generated. It leaks out of the power lines. And you can have more efficient power lines, but we don't have the capacity to do that. This is where creating power on a local scale is so important. You know, we would not be able to, we use so much energy just transporting it. And that's where it's like, you get the techno-futurists who, techno-utopians, because it's all fantasy as well, to have a, they call the, not the carbon economy, that's what we have now, the hydrogen economy. We can store energy with hydrogen cells, technology that just doesn't exist yet.
We're getting there.
I guess we're getting closer with a lot of these things.
Yeah, working on it right up at the Nano Lab at CERN.
But eventually, I mean, I just, and this is something, I think it's a part of maturity to realize that it's not enough. The technology alone will not save us. And that's how we're going to close out this hour. Don't try to take this from me. Don't try to take this from me. Okay, that was Paramore's Now, from those good old days of 2010 or something, I don't know. So we were just jabbing about, during the break in the musical interlude, about, to expand on what I was talking about. I don't, like, we see, so that story we just read combined a lot of different technologies that are either upcoming or even exist now, like those little mini drones, and it put them into a context and a form of action that's verily different than what we're presented with. And it's kind of goes to, we see these demonstrations for Google Glass and the technology.
Yeah, so many of these augmented reality things are just very silly and novelty. Like, ooh, you can see more things to buy, or like see locations that it's I can just, already just like see on my phone.
It's the whole like, it's not, it's never true when someone says like we've invented everything. There's nothing else to innovate on. Well, that's obviously wrong, but it's an end of history kind of thing. Mindset. But I also, when it comes to corporate America, I do not trust them to create technologies and develop actual meaningful and valuable uses for it. Like, they're not socially innovative. They can't imagine social applications. They can only make a product, put it out for middle class early adopters and whoever to buy, to fiddle with. And then there'll be social ramifications that they didn't see coming. Referring to, let's say, Facebook and fake news, which now they're in some bad PR because they stated as policy that we don't know how to ban child porn from Facebook. And pretty much said, we don't really want to tackle it. Like, we can't do it, and we don't know how. We don't know how to get rid of child porn from Facebook. And finally, after all of the bad news, their stock finally went down. But it's just one of those examples that they cannot imagine how their technology could be abused for profit or whatever, even though that's why they created it.
Yeah, but on the positive stuff, though, so you know, that last story gets into actual, really imaginative uses of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You got, augmented reality, showing you around a building, and like, who's doing what, where for your mission. You got,
not just by the state, who's probably the only state and corporations who can develop this technology for themselves and they can afford it, but the regular bystander can't.
Yeah, like this activist using that,
which is where the DIY open source versions of everything comes in.
Yeah, and it's also interesting. Like, they're taking stuff just right out of gaming and then applying it to real life. Like you said, it's like a Splinter Cell, Metal Gear Solid kind
Mirror's
of deal.
Edge. Because Mirror's Edge is where you play as a poor person who is like literally like trafficking illegal information.
Yeah, that's nice. I think it's interesting. Yeah, parkour has been kind of tied to the activist community by some thread or other throughout its entirety. There seem to be a lot of trossers who, either are activists or like have support for it. I think it's because you're always trespassing in parkour on the rooftops and places anyhow.
That's as far as it's regulated, I guess. That is an illegal activity, or rather it is extra legal, meaning it isn't. This is where like something develops and it's neither being regulated by the state and societal rules haven't been developed for it. This comes to the fact that the law is always playing catch-up, right?
There's a new thing.
It wasn't until we had satellite communication for a decade that the Telecommunications Act of 96 was passed. Of course, when it wasn't really about dealing... Well, basically, it was giving the power to consolidate all media into a few players. The mega corps, basically. Your Tyrell Corporation. That's a fictional one, but whatever.
Yeah, another neat tech in the story was I thought, Internet of Things. Internet of Things is very prevalent in that story. The entire building is controlled by an Internet of Things. The entire
smart building.
Yeah, it's a smart building, and that's coming. Well, yeah, it is here, and it's just coming faster and faster in real life.
Applications are just so uninspiring when I see ads or conversations about them. Usually
It's like, whoa, people I can control my thermostat from my phone or whatever. But
yeah.
You can control other people's thermostats from any device the hell you want.
That's usually the fear. Like, so it was the Internet of Things and these other developments have been picked apart by society, even normative society, really easily to see the problems and the ways it could be abused. So, you know, even your normal layman can say, yeah, that's not right. This is going to allow people to take control. The corporation you bought it from will be able to regulate, you know.
Oh, I sure trust them with
that. They can put limits.
Regulating
I mean, my house. More so than now through other means. But, I mean, it just refines it and makes it even more in-your-face, personal.
Yeah, I think Internet of Things, well, really a lot of tech things, it's a meritocracy. If you have more knowledge on how the thing works, you win. But yeah, if you just go on YouTube and, you know, just do some quick searches for like Internet of Things security, there's a wealth of knowledge out there now on all inequality. Kinds of vulnerabilities of these things.
Yeah, which creates inequality, which is why, I see
it does inevitably.
The left's job is pushing back against meritocracy, because a lot of merit, besides the control of information and the information. Is being restricted. You know, information wants to be free is a hacker motto, and it is not. It is there are copyrights on certain information. You can be jailed for a long time for stealing certain the wrong type of information. To try to develop expertise outside of the realm of needing to pay $100,000 for some degree, or working, you need to pay with. Your autonomy by working for a particular enterprise, a firm, the state, where you lose free speech rights, or a corporation, you can also lose free speech rights. You can't share information. This is proprietary. You can't talk about this with anyone else. You can't share this work that you're doing. You know, you don't own it. You almost don't own your own body at that point. You know, you don't own what you make. You don't own your time. So on and so on.
Yeah, that just made me think of an interesting idea, which is that, if all kinds of utilities are getting, if the government's getting more and more into Internet of Things, then if you know how to run the Internet of Things better, you can probably find more and more ways to bypass the state and all kinds of economic regulation on these things. Mm-hmm. Hell, people already do it with cell phones and internet access. You can crack routers and modems to. Get free internet access. You can modify SIM cards for free phone data. As we get more and more into, buildings being run by stuff.
Such an obtuse more skill stuff set, to though.
Exploit.
I find it very, like a wall in front of me. In terms of
I think it's an education thing. Plenty of people couldn't read and write for a while, but you eventually educated lots of people to read and write. So why not with anything?
Right. I think perhaps just as our education system completely unprepares us for many aspects of living. Like the shop class, that's been generally cut back, and the shop class is almost like the fix things class, which it's once it was cut, now we don't know how to maintain houses. Even that simple knowledge of banging two pieces of wood together. Now I got it through a number of programs and things that were private, like summer camps and stuff, and it's just assumed that everyone goes through that. But of course, if you're poor, you don't, unless there's some handout for it and some charity. But otherwise, like to have a shop class that's technical, and I suppose Albany High and other high schools,
lots of
high schools are trying to incorporate a shop class that's for.
There's computers. Some of it in high schools, but it's mostly going on libraries right now. The public libraries are really taking that role right now. Heck, you go right over to the Albany Public Library, and they got Makerspace in there. They got a few staff there, but it's mostly the kids teaching each other. I mean, heck, when I walked in there, like, I was learning more from the students doing stuff in there than I was from any of the staff.
It can be very uncomfortable for a lot of people, and I'm talking about myself. Kids teaching me a thing. But I suppose you just have to be open to it. And then you can get into the habit of learning from other people, even those who are younger, because they have been around it in a different way than you have, and so on. Am I close to the mic now? I feel like I've been too far away. I'll find out later. So where do you want to go next?
We can get into the ancient democracies.
I could talk about the... Right. We just have another minute or so. So I'll just vamp about solarpunk art and how it was mentioned briefly before that... Actually, it wasn't mentioned in the manifesto. That when people talk about solarpunk art, it's two styles come to mind. Going back to Art Deco and Art Nouveau. And these were two art styles that are both exist within the modern period of art. Art Nouveau being pre-World War I, but after Victorian era. So it's post, it's that area, but after what steampunk would be, but before the modern era of World War I started. So, and it's more, it's very naturalistic. It had this thing about organic forms, a lot of curves, and a lot of the shapes moving into from one to another. And using naturalistic representation and things. Art Deco, more geometric, but still great compositions of good shapes. And it's the modern, sharp, you know, aesthetic. There's the streamlined modernism of, like, of trailers, of, like, those...
sharp edges, orderliness.
Well, but no. And sometimes the streamlined modernism is where there are no edges.
Oh, yeah, nice and sleek and curved.
Right. And going back to that as well, because they fit within a natural context as well. So a lot of solarpunk art and architecture, when discussing it, when people create little sketches and what would it be like, those two things pop out the most. I even outsourced the creation of the logo for the show, a new logo, and I basically described this to the artist, graphic artist, like, can you make something that's Art Nouveau? He loves Art Deco as well. So he was kind of interested, and he did a good swipe at it. And so you can see that on the Facebook page and whatnot. So we're coming back from our solarpunk tin show, talking about possible optimistic or positive futures. Now we're going to take a break from that by going into the past. Don't ask me why, but I just feel like doing that at this time. Because I have these two stories that have been in my, my queue. So the first one is, I'm going to do the bread one. So this is via Gizmodo, but there is also via Science, the journal Science, which is a bit drier, Science website I go to, Science Daily. But this is from Gizmodo, so it's got a little more personality, I guess. Discovery of 14,000-year-old toast suggests bread can now be added to the paleo diet. Now, for those didn't know what that meant, the paleo diet is kind of one of those fad diets where people grasp at what the best way of eating is in our society of junk food and prepared and preserved and pink slime. And our terribly industrial, overworked food system that only has a good 50 years left. After another 40 or 50 years, we cannot farm anymore the way that we currently do. So expect food prices to be going up as a rule, and push, as I do, for more, not some just organic farming, but sustainable permaculture farming, which we can actually grow even more than we do now, and not waste it like we do now. We waste like half of the food grown, or in the entire food system. So take that to heart. But that's off topic. Archaeologists have uncovered the earliest evidence of bread making at a site. Actually, can you do this one?
Archaeologists have uncovered the earliest evidence of bread making at a site in northeastern Jordan. Dating back some 14,400 years, the discovery shows that ancient hunter-gatherers were making and eating bread 4,000 years before the Neolithic era and the introduction of agriculture. So much for the paleo diet actually being a thing.
I'll mention that science articles don't have the paleo diet angle, so there's a lot of...
Yeah, not too big on it.
There's the... Well, because Gizmodo, these are technophiles, I guess. So there's a kind of a, what do you call it? Salt? Yeah, they're adding salt to it. Being salty. So, which isn't totally... What's interesting about this is just that when it comes to... This is most archaeology, always pushing back the date of when certain things developed. Whether it be certain technologies, language, it just keeps getting pushed back as to these things that we consider that makes us human, or what make humans modern, like the making of bread. It's like, well, we can only make bread after farming, but here we have to scramble those dates again. We have bread made before farming. And I already kind of knew this because I had watched a documentary, kind of a Nat Geo kind of thing, of Australian bushmen. So these are the quote-unquote primitive people, the aboriginals. And he was making bread with nothing but some ground-up roots and dirt and basically some hot stones and burying the dough in, heating them up with a fire, putting out the fire, putting the dough in the crevice made by the fire, covering it, and then the dough cooks, and then... clean, you know, and unburies it and then cleans it off, and boom, he has like a piece of like kind of weird hardtack bread. So the humans have been doing this for our entire history, and this kind of discovery is more about finding actual like bread making facilities in the settlement. So that's... Yeah, so that's pretty much it for this story. We can move on to the next one, which is has a bit more meat to it, which is about how the only democracies... So usually our narrative are Western, which doesn't exist. Western civilization myth is that only in Europe, like Greece and Venice, do we have democracies and republics. And the rest of the world, human civilizations, which are implied inferior, or always a despotic, always top down. Of course, republics are top down too, but you know, less so. But what archaeologists are finding, based on circumstantial and direct evidence, is that there are republics all over the world in any varying area. And this one in particular is in Mexico. So at the same time as the great Aztec Empire, which is very despotic, there was a city-state that was a republic. So I'll read from the beginning paragraphs here. The candidate for political office stood in a plaza, naked, bracing himself against the punches and kicks. The crowd roared, pulsing around him like a beating heart. People for whom he had risked his life in war after war hurled blows and insults from all directions. The candidate breathed deeply. Trained as a warrior, he knew he had to stay calm to reach the next phase of his candidacy. This ordeal, documented by a Spanish priest in the 1500s, was merely the beginning of the long process of joining the government of the Mesoamerican city of Tlaxcalan, built around 1250 CE, in the hills surrounding the modern city of Tlaxcala, Mexico. After this trial ended, the candidate would enter the temple on the edge of the plaza and stay for up to 2 years while priests drilled him in the city's moral and legal codes. He would be starved, beaten, and spiked with whips if he fell asleep, and required to cut himself in bloodletting rituals. But when he walked out of the temple, he would be more than a warrior. He would be a member of the Tlaxcalan Senate, one of the 100 or so men who made the city's most important military and economic decisions. I'd like to see more modern politicians do all that just to prove they can govern, says archaeologist Lane Fargo, standing in the shadow of one of the recently restored elevated plazas. So something of note is that this city, instead of having one central plaza with a bunch of pyramids around it, has a bunch of smaller plinths, stages, one in each neighborhood. Now this is something I would like to see in our cities. Each park, I mean, we have a few band shells and stages here and there, but to have one in each little pocket park, to have one specific to each neighborhood, a place to gather. Because otherwise, like, let's say in Swishbourne Park, which is one of the parks in Albany here, there is no such plinth. There's no stage. And so when there was a public event, a community gathering, they had to bring in like kind of a, like a deck truck and as an elevated stage, which is a little higher than it needed to be and seemed excessive as well. And they're distributed around the city, and there's a main one. And they note that there's no major palace, that the kind of the houses of those that governed were more modest. There's less inequality. And they call this collective governance. And they mean collective as far as that the those that governed were picked out of the general population and not through dynasties or priesthoods chosen by God or whatever. So we count as a collective government, though using that word is not what we would use. But as far
that's
as
how the archaeologists would call us,
this is their terminology.
We fall under that umbrella of collective.
Something they noticed between city-states across the world, including in Europe, that and the more despotic, is the despotism, the fascist, are that their wealth was based on the gathering of internal taxation. So the wealth is coming from a little bit of everyone who lives there, while despotic governments are getting their wealth from some external source of wealth, control of trade, control of some other resource, like gold and oil. I mean, you kind of see it with our own country, where in the 50s, our golden age, it was we had a high tax rate. We funded all these things, the space program, with internal taxes and the growth of our economy. Since the 70s, going off the gold standard and the shift to late capitalism, all of our wealth is coming from abroad. Trade, free trade with the finding new markets and places to extract wealth and value from workers abroad. But I think I covered the major points of this article. It's longer. They go into the actual history that they actually were a rival of what is now Mexico City, Tenochtitlan.
Yeah, that was the part I found particularly interesting was that the people, cities are also just smaller back then, so people paid proportionally more taxes, so the politicians were that much more accountable to the people. And I also found it interesting they said that a lot of these collective cities were organized in just a pretty grid-like fashion.
They
seem to correlate egalitarianism.
It
with,
shows up
the grid in, structure in the city.
And you can look at one neighborhood in America and say that it has that similar type, but that's within class. If you look at the entire metropolitan area, then the inequalities show up. I mean, one quip about skylines is that it's property values rendered in a 3D, three-dimensional bar graph.
Huh. Wow.
Right? Amazing. Higher the property value, the higher the wealth, taller the buildings. And that's represented in everything else. I think we'll hit that. And that ties into another concept I'll mention in the last section, so stay tuned. What else can we talk about with this? We still have a bit of time. I guess I could shift to the random topic that I have queued up, which is unrelated to solar punk and futurism and history even, but just something that popped up. So random news time. Random news segment. So something that popped up and it wouldn't take long to talk about it is, so I'm a Green Party, and there are some members in the Green Party that want to do certain outreach to those that could be considered potential radicals, potential allies. And they use, just as we have this concept of left unity, which is slowly falling out of style, because what we really have and should have are coalitions based around common issues and goals. He uses bottom unity as an impetus to start what has been started, the Libertarian Socialist Caucus of the Libertarian Party. So the Libertarian Party is very capitalist, historically funded by billionaires, perhaps still so, but at least not so much, and filled with a lot of people, they got a big boost of younger people from the Ron Paul revolution. So before Bernie Sanders and that kind of movement, or an Occupy even, you had the Ron Paul revolution in, I guess it was 06, 08, I don't know. And
yeah, like 08.
So they've started what's called Libertarian Socialist Caucus. Libertarian Socialists are what we are. Would you agree with that? Or are you okay with that?
I'm not falling under any umbrella here.
That's true. Okay.
But it's who we're talking about.
It's just that mix of socialism and anarchism, social anarchism. These labels refer to bottom-up planning, bottom-up communities, and common ownership of resources, particularly common resources like land, water, and in general, valuable skills like healthcare, or the creation of medicine, means of production kind of stuff. So they've created a caucus, and they've made quite a stir because this party, Libertarian Party, is also kind of, they have neo-Nazi and far-right nationalist infiltrators. And now they have these left-wing infiltrators, as the mainstays would call them. And they've started an interesting initiative that I hope people in the Green Party copy, if not they're already doing, which is to initiative to recruit sex worker candidates. So these are the kind of things that, because libertarians and other right-wingers, some of them are very conservative, they talk about liberty and personal autonomy, and yet they are not for rights for sex workers, and they're not for people having personal choices, abortion rights, and basically because they're misogynist jerks, doofuses, who don't think about the contradictions in what they say about property rights, and there's so strong property rights, and mixing your labor with the land, as if you do it once and then it's yours forever. And these are the kind of ideas they spout out. So I'm going to read out this because this applies. This isn't just applying to. That's almost just the background of where this is coming from. So this is just started by one member. They had a candidate for chair. They're pretty much guys like me. Literally like me. My goal is to normalize sex work and sow workers within the Libertarian Party. Ideally enough, sex workers will take up positions and leadership and responsibility, that sex work decriminalization will be a major and consistent message for the party, just as cannabis legalization used to be, stated Libertarian Socialist Caucus of the Libertarian Party member Johnny Robinson. The initiative is called Pornocracy Now. The group seeks to recruit sex workers to run for office under the Libertarian Party banner and take up leadership roles within the party, while also encouraging current members to welcome sex workers and assist in their activism. Okay, so I misread that. I thought he was like encouraging members to become sex workers, which is no, assist.
Wow,
in
that'd
the,
be pretty radical.
Assist in the activism of sex workers. Well, you know, I hear that in IWW where it's like, well, you know, if you're going to organize service workers, you should be working at a burger joint or a supermarket.
Yeah, I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
You should at least kind of foot in the door.
Embed yourself, infiltrate, if you want to be negative. Infiltrate sounds negative, and it is. So it's more about embedding, learning, being a part of that, instead of being from afar. Far too many libertarians look down on sex workers, even if their official line is, I don't care about what you do, your body, your choice, etc., etc. They don't seem to have the same disgust towards other professions that are more physically hazardous, or whose day-to-day work is more demeaning. Also, far too many libertarians have fallen for the disinformation put out by those who are opposed to the existence of the sex worker, and who conflate all sex work with rape, child exploitation, and human trafficking. Now, these are all real problems, but they mostly come from the fact that it is illegal to do any of it, where you do not allow the good version, the good behavior, you will get the bad. Just saying. Yeah, and they have a sex worker on the national committee whose name is Starchild, who is a bisexual sex worker who stated in 2016... I think there's more sex workers who are libertarians than there are proportionally in the general population. So this is just her line. Being a libertarian gives you a very different perspective on the law. More flexible? I realized more than I had before. Now, this is about actually protecting women. So, on the left, there are what are I would call reactionary feminists. These are TERFs. These are like anti-trans women. These are... They believe that any person who's trans is like a man pretending to be a woman. Like, you have to have a vagina to be a woman. Or something like that. They're all very... They're mostly terrible people, very dogmatic. And I have one argument about, like, that all sexual content of any kind is, like, bad. But the argument is almost like, well, then all work under capitalism because there's no consent there. That's bad. And that's true. Mm. I'm not a fan of capitalism because there's no informed consent. We're not informed about how the process and how our economy works. And there's really no consent. We earn an income or we have nothing. No choice there.
Or we build solar punk utopias.
Yeah. Exactly. How do we do that? And so it's basically doing all of the radical small things that I promote on this show and want to promote more of. So we're just kind of starting with this primer almost to imagine how we take these separate parts like autonomous zones and
Occupy. I didn't want to derail.
No, please do.
Much, but,
no, please do.
Yeah, how do we do it? I mean, people are already doing it. As far as I'm concerned, solar punk already exists and has existed for a while. It's just finally getting a name and an aesthetic and a more of a whole package to it. But like, there have been people last couple of years, and it's a growing trend of people. Going around with solar backpacks, solar bikes, people in the squatter community are, techifying, they're squatting more. You got more people starting off-grid farms. I'm working on one myself. You got people doing, DIY, battery power of all sorts.
Sorry to cut you off, but I actually I need to go back to do our last break. Lost track of the timing of things. So we'll be back with our last segment where we continue this rambling, but also try to wrap up things. That was not meant to be a slam. All right.
Looking for a job worth talking about? Teaching is creative, collaborative, and intellectually challenging. See why teachers have better work stories at teachdfw.org and learn more about becoming a teacher. Brought to you by Teach and the Ad Council.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
No borders, no nations. So we're going to wrap up our show about solar punk. I'm going to really condense, which is quite a hard task, from Medium. Medium has its own solar punk's page here with a bunch of articles, so I'm going to link to that. And one of them is on the political dimensions of solar punk. So this is a really long and meandering essay.
It's a good one, though.
But I'm going, it's got a lot of great stuff in it. And so I'm just going to relate the things I really liked quickly. So his first part is called Something Stirs, and it kind of goes about how, in our millennials, especially millennials and beforehand, we are starving for a positive future. Because hopelessness gets, even that gets old pretty fast. The whole nihilistic, nothing matters, there's no hope. Obviously suicide rates are rising. And that's just another more casualties in a war that is not declared. Unless it's called the war on poverty by killing poor people. And the war on drugs by killing those who use drugs. We don't think of it that way, but that's actually how it is. Let's go via my notes here. So he talks about how, we're in an aging world. America, Japan is kind of where it's the worst. They need to invent robots to take care of all the people. And here in America, we have a government that is completely controlled by the old. Old ideas, old ways of thinking, all still stuck in a 20th century mindset. So I am pessimistic about taking power from them. They're living longer. Even those that are 50 and older are going to be, when they are replaced by the 50-year-olds, they are going to live even longer, stay in power longer. I mean, the fact that we have an 80-year-old as president right now, he's almost 80, right? Trump. So back to millennial, back to boomers. You know, I think Obama was supposed to be the Gen X president, and then we have a younger president than him or another Gen Xer. And that didn't happen. We went back to boomers because they're just, yeah. And so we need to, since we're not really going to overthrow the government anytime soon or do it at all.
How pessimistic.
Well, we're going to state that as such. So let's assume we're going to take that conclusion. Other episodes, we will say the opposite. We're going to have pockets of resistance and an outside the status quo. And work in there. Work where the state has neglected, abandoned things. You know, the state has abandoned Flint. It's not rebuilding its pipes. So the people of Flint, if we give them help, it shouldn't be in truckloads of bottled water. It should be in the equipment to gather rain and gather rainwater and treat and projects to clean the water and not rely on the pipes that are just unusable now. You know, disconnect. That takes time, but at least that needs to be a starting point instead of trying to just, because it's not being funded by anyone. Even Elon Musk, even the people with billions of dollars will not pay to replace their pipes. Only filters.
Got to create new options.
In cities, we need to reuse the environment. So a lot of futurism is imagining new things. But that is kind of the old way of tearing down and rebuilding everything. We don't have the resources for that, and we shouldn't have to use the resources to rebuild everything. So when imagining a solar punk future and a future for ourselves, it's about reusing what we have. DIY culture is all about gathering the little pieces of things and making something new and something that's needed now. We can see the sky as a source of our problems with climate chaos, disasters, and storms, but it is also the source of a salvation through wind and solar energy. Part three of his essay is called Rubble, Seed, and Fog. This is where he gets into his actual opinions. But we're entering a period of fierce domination and slow failure. That is what we're in. He calls this a bloated malnourishment. Like when someone is, you know, appears healthy, they eat a lot of junk food. They have a good income, let's say, but under the surface, they're developing heart disease. They're developing diabetes. There are these diseases that kill you slower. And it's a slow failure, even if, say, on the outside, you know, you can win a fight or you're reasonably healthy, well fed at the very least. You're well fed via junk food. You know, and we're all reacting to our real need for real progress and meaning. Everyone who even identifies someone on the left wants a real sense of progress. And they know that liberal government and the Democratic Party, let's say, or definitely the Republican Party, you know, the status quo warriors are not offering real progress. They sell it, but, you know, with their little hopey changey, whatever, you know, it's make fun of that. And real meaning, because crass consumption and just going to the movies isn't providing one with enough meaning. Geek and nerd culture isn't enough. Consumption and whatnot. A lot has been said already about that. So there are kind of, and this is his opinion, that it's kind of a dual dead end to either overthrow the system completely or to reform it. because it definitely doesn't want to be reformed. Inside, there's the anarchist praxis. The middle way is actually the anarchist practice of working in the places where there are openings and opportunities, of that guerrilla gardening. We're both doing that. How do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah. Guerrilla gardening, squatting, yeah, particularly like areas where, you know, there's people are complaining like, there's all these house closings, all these properties are getting abandoned, you know, like Detroit and, you know, Baltimore and places like that. I mean, heck, Schenectady right near here. I don't see enough people talking about, you know, like really taking advantage of Schenectady.
Filling in the space. Pretty much, it's just empty space that the quote unquote proper owners are not doing anything with.
Yeah, the state's literally not doing its job.
The rightful owner, right? The rightful owner has abandoned it functionally. It's just on paper that they own it and put up a no trespassing sign. Because apparently if you do something to it, you can only hurt the property value more. but in Detroit, you know, you have entire blocks that have been raised and they're starting farms within the city grid structure. And that's beautiful stuff. So conversely, there's his section on if we fail, and he kind of lists the certain bad futures that go beyond just the cyberpunk that we are well acquainted with via actual Hollywood movies. There's the kind of future where biopower comes back instead of solar. Like, we didn't take the time to develop the renewable energy, or rather the renewable energy is now back to the carbon of having big livestock animals. Cloning mammoths. You know, there's a sci-fi story of that.
You know, biofuels. Yeah, there's...
Right, and any kind of
biofuel. Yeah, and biofuel is, you know, very DIYable. You know, you go to your local makerspace, like, you know, find some, you know, local chemists at a college near you. You can talk to a lot of chemistry geeks about, you know, trying to start up doing biofuel.
Well, the other week, I covered a story about how biomass, and this was mostly wood products, is more carbon intensive than coal. So keep that in mind. There is sprawl punk, which is the kind of, it's a green future, but it's over planned. It's those eco city concepts that come out of Dubai and China, where the whole city is planned out and it's entirely empty and devoid of life. And you have all of these systems, it's well engineered, but it's almost over engineered. There's no spontaneity. There's no, and it's for the rich, you know, a solar punk.
Yeah,
and then you can have kind of the solar punk for the few.
Yeah, they built it, but yeah, nobody had some money to go.
Yeah, when you have the Google campus or some tech campus where it's like they throw out all the sustainability bells and whistles that they built in. Okay, you can afford that. How does somebody in the inner city get that? They have no answer. And it's like, well, their answer is usually the market will lower the costs eventually. That's bunk. Gotta say that. Then there's the jackpot future, which is we can live better and more ecological and have the solar punk future, the positive future, but only after 80% of us die off in some cataclysm. And that shouldn't be an option. It shouldn't be something that we're hoping or even like we don't want that. We want to be able to transition. So we have the transition town movement. Strong towns is another one that's a little more liberal leaning markets, you know, getting real estate to work with you somehow. So then the way forward and some of his kind of offhand advice. We don't want to idealize the gothic high tech, referring to the techno-utopianism, or what he calls the favela chic, which is people going out into slums in the third world and saying, look how spontaneous and lively this is. It's like, well, and the life expectancy isn't that high. And it's like, but there's a do-it-yourself culture and everyone's doing things on their own because they have to. But that's that one of those aspects mentioned in the beginning of the show when we were defining solar punk. So we want to take things from that, but we don't want to depend on the future being where all cities are refugee camps. It's in the refugee camp that he kind of talks about. Yeah, I want to live in that
future.
He takes a tangent on that. He says, don't be optimistic, but hopeful. I don't know how to feel about that, because I actually find I would switch that. Don't hope for a future. Be optimistic. And I guess one is considered to be you're just thinking and dreaming instead of doing. And when you have hope, hope drives you to action. Like when we call Star Wars for the New Hope, there's resistance and a rebellion there instead of just saying, oh, it'd be nice if we didn't have a big empire with its feet on its throat. I'm optimistic that it will get better. He suggests the tautology, which is where you have like two concepts that depend on each other. The product of community is the movement. Right, so you have a solar punk community that creates a solar punk movement. But also that the movement's main product is also community. So a tautology is it's circular reasoning. It's like, so where do you start? You know, you create a movement that creates community, or do you build community that becomes a movement? And I think this is the main puzzle for activists these days of getting out of the loop of lobbying the government, working on the grassroots, how to actually do that effectively and organize. We want to inspire people. We want to do more than just build email lists where we send out mobilization orders. Nobody responds well to that. And also teach others skills. Teach one, try one. A place where artists become activists and activists become planners. So my journey in the last few years is going from activist to planner, you know, not just going from event to event, but planning an organization, planning the show is my one expression of that. And joining a garden project is another, because we're doing rain capture and animal management. These are really interesting things. So with that, so I'll just sign off. We are on iTunes. Find us there by searching for The Three Lefts Show. Our website is Three Lefts, and this is both of numeral, threelefts.news. There is a page with all of the episodes. And there's a Facebook page, and you can like and also support us on Patreon. Again, Three Left Show, all of these different things link to each other or provide the address so that you can search for it.
Check out some Solar Punk online.
Oh, and please do.
Better future is possible.
Search for it and you'll get the art. You'll get the articles. Google that Solar Punk. So with that, let me just cue up some music. Ciao.